It's the turn of a new century. From the roof of his new hotel, Michael could look down the river to the spot where Ely had first docked in the 1880s as a young man. He could look along the Bund to the Kadouri's Palace Hotel, where Chiang Kai-shek had held his wedding reception, and Baghdadi immigrants had kissed the back of Ely's outstretched hand seeking favors. Turning the other way, he could look out onto Hong Kyu, the old Jewish ghetto where Horace had built his school and the garden bridge over which the first Japanese and the communists had marched, ending the reign of the British and the Kadouris over Shanghai. At the grand opening of the new Peninsula Hotel on the Bund, Michael hired acrobats dressed as bellhops to scale the facade. Costumed Chinese drummers beat large drums at the entrance as Chinese and British movie stars, officials, and a handful of royalty mingled in the marble lobby, posed for photographs, and sipped champagne. "We are proud to have come home," Michael declared. It was a party Victor Sassoon would have enjoyed. For a century, the Kadouris had met with and advised every Chinese leader except for Mao. Now Michael met regularly with Deng's successors and with Xi Jinping, China's powerful new president. At a meeting with 24 Hong Kong business leaders, Michael was the only Westerner present. Xi took a moment and sent an aide over to shake Michael's hand and deliver a personal message, quote, "Your family has always been a friend to China," end quote. That's from the concluding chapter of The Last Kings of Shanghai, the rival Jewish dynasties that helped create modern China by Jonathan Kaufman. And I start with the end rather than the beginning on purpose, because this is indeed an epic nonfiction tale, the tale of two family dynasties, as our subtitle indicates, who helped to create what we know of today as modern China. More on that later. Something there is about biography that pulls us in and keeps us turning pages, even at a time that none of us remember or few of us have a connection with today. The true life stories told here are amazing. We open with the late 19th century, the early 20th century, when the world had yet to know of world wars, at least not since the Napoleonic Wars that wrapped up by the early 1800s. Optimism was rampant as our book opens. The modern world as we know it today was taking shape. Cities were electrifying. Extensive public transportation was becoming an urban norm, and telegraph and aeroplanes were making getting to far-flung parts of the world much more doable for anyone, at least for anyone with some money. It was an exciting time to live for men and women who were excited by the new and burgeoning world around them and had the moxie and the cash, or at least the ability to get the cash, to engage fully in those new opportunities. And so it was for the two Jewish families who are the protagonists in our story today. One, the Sassoons, had a long and fruitful history in Baghdad and in French Middle East in affairs, where they had been quite close to the Turkish overlords who were, before the French, were in charge of the area. The Sassoons had built up a huge commercial and financial empire, until they were chased out by the Turkish government, which had had a change of mind. Pulling up stakes and moving to the world of British India and then on to coastal China, which the British, among others, were tearing open with gunboat diplomacy, the Sassoons, the Baghdadi Sassoons, soon enough became a family of newly reestablished wealth. They changed and became solidly British in their citizenry, and secured their investments in the colonial worlds, still in the Middle East, but increasingly in India and China. The Sassoons' rivals and sometime allies, the Kadouris, were an up-and-coming family, also from Baghdad, also Jewish, who were business relatives of the Sassoons, finding their fortune suddenly at an ebb at the turn of the last century, with the death in the family. The Kadouri sons are sent out of country to work for their then-allies, the Sassoons. And so it is that the Kadouris, led particularly by the industrious and entrepreneurial son Ely, find a new family fortune first in India, and soon thereafter in the British Crown Colony of Hong Kong. Then, Ely breaks off into the internationally controlled city of Shanghai, whose commercial and growing industrial wealth was almost totally controlled by British, American, and French colonial capitalists. And so it is that for this very, very exciting book, the chapters move pretty darn quickly. We read the story of the Kadouris and the Sassoons, Victor and Ely in particular. They are the lens through which so much of the clash of these two Jewish dynasties in China is seen. Surely Ely and Victor were prototypical entrepreneurs of their time, and one could argue of ours. They were smart, they craved power, and they claimed it through their business dealings. But financial power was not to become the be-all and the end-all of Ely Kadouri's passion. Again, the family rivalry with the Sassoons spurred Ely to spend considerable effort integrating himself into the clearly stuffy and tradition-bound British upper classes, whether those British be in China, in India, or back in London. Power for Ely Kadouri meant not only financial well-being, but social recognition as well. An oddity of the times frustrated this particular passion for much of Ely's adult life. Born in Baghdad into a Jewish family, Ely was, by the colonial legalism of that day, French. But with his mastery of the English language, his marriage to an upper-class British woman, and the focus of British success on British-ruled areas of China, he was at the outbreak of World War I a hugely successful and rich businessman turned investor, but in too many ways a man and a family without a firm national identity. How he worked his way to the top of both finance and society is the story of Ely Kadouri and his family up to the devastation of the Great Depression and the imperial designs of Japan that arrived soon thereafter. Indeed, the tumultuous 1930s and 1940s arrived. They tore apart the family fortunes, but tore them in different ways. The immediately pre- and post-World War II years and the ensuing decades brought out some of the best in the Kadouris and the Sassoons and put them under severe stress as well. It is here that we learn a bit more about the incredible work done by these Jewish leaders based in China and Hong Kong as they welcomed refugees from Nazi persecution in the 1930s, welcoming perhaps as many as 18,000 men, women, children who traveled from European lands far from China. It brought them to a China that welcomed them because of the Sassoons and the Kadouris. The 1940s brought the Japanese invasions of Shanghai and Hong Kong along with the rest of China, and internment for those who remained in Shanghai and Hong Kong. That included significant members of the Kadouris and the Sassoons. That period was followed by the civil war between Chiang Kai-shek and the communists. When Mao and his comrades won the field, the Jewish dynasties that had done so much to push the modern world into China and to enrich themselves tentatively reached out to the new leaders from their revived fortunes in British Hong Kong. And here is where our story changes so astonishingly. The Sassoons were basically kicked out of and chose to leave the new communist China. The Kadouris, on the other hand, decided that they were going to attempt to curry favor with the Chinese, the new Chinese government, and decided that from their base in Hong Kong, they could perhaps make a go of it still in communist-ruled China. As you heard in our introductory words there, things did not work out so well when Mao was in power for his many years in leading the Chinese. But once Mao left, indeed, the Kadouris' options of staying in Hong Kong and remaining tied in some way to China would pay dividends for the Kadouri family. Let me mention as well that, as another reviewer has written, and I totally agree, quote, "What blew me away the most were the absolutely brilliant and strong women that were operating within the business world of the Sassoons and the Kadouris." This reviewer goes on to write, "Those ladies were way ahead of their time, even more so than their astonishing male relatives, and I wish they could not have been sabotaged like they ended up being in the story that is told here. Indeed, the Kaduri women, who are not necessarily the feature of every chapter, nonetheless bring a story of women's emancipation to this tale that is well worth reading on its own. It's a story of women who were not standing behind their men so much as standing with their men and sometimes standing out in front of them in terms of making their life and the lives of those around them a much better place to be. All of this raises the question, I think, did these rival dynasties, as our subtitle tells us, really help create modern China? Perhaps the key words here are help to create modern China, for help can be a wonderfully squishy word in its meaning. China and Shanghai, its largest city and port to the outside world, were both in the midst of seismic changes as our story unfolds. And from the very first pages at the 1880s into the early 20th century. As you may remember, a corrupt imperial Chinese court was wobbling in its ability to rule their vast nation. For more than a number of years, revolutionaries had been poking and prodding the imperial regime to recognize the danger Western powers portended for China. As so many of the increasingly educated elites in China watched as Japan deliberately chose to learn from and adapt to the West, they sought in vain for their government to do the same. A bit of name-dropping now, for it is in the maelstrom of potential and sometimes chaotic change that our rival Jewish dynasties did find themselves embroiled in more than just enriching their own families. Because of their deep investments in China, and because of their interest in building a financially successful China, that was how they were going to make money, after all, both the Sassoons and the Kaduris were familiar not only to the Chinese government of the day, but to the revolutionaries who were to sweep the inept Chinese imperial government from power. Sun Yat-sen and then Chiang Kai-shek were correspondents with both families, as well as beneficiaries, in particular, of the Kaduris' financial backing at critical times in their efforts to govern the vast and fractured nation. Indeed, at one point, the author makes the analogy of China in the early 1900s as what the U.S. would have been had the British continued to hold New York City and other major population centers with a restive series of southern states, even as the United States government in Washington had achieved its independence. But analogies are not needed as these pages turn. For the Chinese citizenry were living proof to anyone who would look to see that the native population were almost always getting the low end of the effort by their colonial overlords. The Chinese were prohibited, even in Shanghai, even in their major city, from engaging with foreigners in major foreign developments, whether that be hotels or parks or schools or even government, which for quite a while was run by non-Chinese colonial overlords. As the decades pass, the efforts by the Kaduri family in particular to invest not only in China, but in the Chinese people grabs our attention more strongly as the chapters roll by. For all the dramatic and wonderful stories told here, the writing is brisk and easy to read. This is not a heavily footnoted book, although it is a significantly researched book, as the notes in the conclusion inform us. The author wants to tell the story of these two Jewish dynasties. I'll leave it up to you to decide whether they helped create modern China or whether they were an impediment to China discovering what it really could be without so much Western influence. Regardless, the Kaduris and the Sassoons certainly played a major role in making the China of today the China that we know, for good, for ill, or perhaps for in the inevitable, for good, for ill, for whatever China was going to become. Let's finish by reading once again from the concluding chapter. It is a good indicator, I think, to why this book is such an interesting and fascinating read. You can agree with the subtitle, you can disagree with the subtitle. Nonetheless, there is so much to learn, so many interesting people to meet in these pages. As the conclusion begins, the Sassoon diaspora that had spread after the death of David Sassoon in 1864, deposited family members around the globe, in London, Jerusalem, Washington, D.C., and New York, and in professions ranging from banking to government to arts to rabbinic studies. The family fortune dwindled and dissipated. Much of Victor's wealth, which had made him one of the richest men in the world in the 1930s, was tied to the Cathay Hotel and scores of other buildings he owned in Shanghai, which the communists seized. Over the years, family members made occasional efforts to get the Chinese government to compensate them. They were always rebuffed. The Kadouris, by contrast, had fled Shanghai for Hong Kong, remained committed to China's rise under the communists, and reaped the benefits. For the Sassoons, Shanghai had slipped into the nostalgia of family lore and memory. Hugh Sassoon, a London banker and descendant of the formidable Flora Sassoon, was being interviewed for a background check at one point before entering a deal. As part of the routine questioning, he was asked if he had ever engaged in money laundering. He chuckled. Quote, "My family used to be in the drug trade," end quote, he said. One Sassoon who maintained the family connection to Shanghai was James Sassoon, Hugh's son, who traveled often to China for business and became head of the leading British business group that advocated for trade with China. In 2013, he became a top executive at Jardine Matheson, the same company that his family had battled and outwitted in the opium trade in the 1870s. In 2002, James Sassoon was named a senior official for the British Treasury. He was sent to Beijing for economic talks and met with China's finance minister. As often happened on these trips, the Sassoon name and its history preceded him. "Your family's name is very well known in China," the finance minister began. James Sassoon acknowledged that, and they talked a bit about his family's history and Victor's vast holdings in Shanghai and elsewhere. Then the young Sassoon added, impishly, quote, "It is a shame that China has not implemented the policy that many countries in Eastern Europe adopted, where they have allowed former owners to come back and reclaim their properties. If China did that, our family would be much better off," end quote. The finance minister looked at him and broke into a smile. He switched to English and leaned forward. Quote, "Let's let bygones be bygones," end quote. It's quite a story, and it's quite a story that is probably widely unknown until this book, and hopefully it will become better known. The Last Kings of Shanghai, the Rival Jewish Dynasties That Helped Create Modern China. Do what you will with the title and the subtitle. It's still a fascinating story of entrepreneurial efforts, of colonialism, and of the rise of the China we know today. It's written by Jonathan Kaufman. It's available all of our fine local libraries, including the West Lafayette Public Library. Thank you for listening.